Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, crime takes center stage with a stabbing death in South End on public transit, and that has City Council concerned.
Clearly, our current safety policies are not enough.
It's back to school at CMS, which goes smoothly, but with instances of parents getting arrested for bringing weapons on campus at Palisades High School. We get an update on CMS test scores and how changes to SNAP and Medicaid may affect the school lunch program for some. And the legislature, with no real prospect of passing a budget, is back in session with plans to meet monthly, sometimes online. Plus, the Panthers roster is set for the start of the NFL season. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE News Senior Editor Eli Portillo. WFAE's education reporter James Farrell is also with us. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So last Friday night, Irina Zarutska, a 23-year-old recently arrived from Ukraine, was found fatally stabbed at a South End light rail station near Camden Road. Most murders in Charlotte are committed by people who know the victim. That was not the case here. And in fact, the Observer, I think it was the Observer reporting this morning, that they have now video of the incident occurring on the train. Tell us what we know.
Well, this happened last Friday at about 10:30 while the train was near the East-West Light Rail station. So really busy time at a really popular place in Southend. And what we've learned is that the suspect and the victim had no known connections and no prior interactions. The mother of the suspect, DeCarlos Brown, has told WSOC that he suffered from schizophrenia and had previously been involuntarily hospitalized. And what police have said is that this took place with no interaction besides him stabbing her without any words even being said on the train.
According to what I read this morning, and in a description of the video, he was sitting in an adjacent seat. They went a while, and then he pulls out a pocket knife, opens the knife, stands up, and then stabs her in the neck, and she falls to the floor of the bus. The police found him on the platform when they came to respond to this. They found him on the platform.
Yes, and he was found right there, identified by witnesses. He was taken to the hospital and was there for almost a week. He has now been booked into Mecklenburg County Jail and formally charged. It appears to be, you know, just like we said, a random attack. And like you alluded to at the beginning, the vast majority of homicides are committed between people who know each other in some capacity. Right. This is really the kind of high-profile crime in a random area that sets people on edge.
For a good reason. Eric?
Yeah, it's interesting, Mike, that this, this young woman tragically loses her life, but it has become, as Eli alluded to, because I think of the circumstances, it has really become a lightning rod quickly, politically, with the Fraternal Order of Police issued a really harsh statement this week. And you heard, you played a little bit of Dimple Ashmira, you've heard council members already going back and forth searching for answers and bringing this into the transit tax debate. So this one tragic event is having all kinds of repercussions beyond just what happened that night.
Yeah, this is not the first instance of crimes being committed on our transit system. And this happened on Friday night, as Eli said, but on Monday, the council happened to have their regularly scheduled meeting, and several members spoke about that attack, which was perpetrated on a several members talked about another attack that was perpetrated in Pineville on a 57-year-old veteran on a CATS bus. You alluded to Dimple Ajmera. We heard a snippet of what she said at that hearing, and we're about to hear some more of it, because she, after recent violent attacks, called on City Manager Marcus Jones to inform council on the immediate steps that are being taken to ensure the safety of CATS riders and operators.
Clearly, our current safety policies are not enough. And with the referendum this November, I'm even more concerned, because we cannot let fear drive people away.
Did Marcus Jones have a response, or is it just too soon? She asked, is it too soon to expect a response being asked from the dais on council?
Yeah, I don't think we have an immediate response other than I'll let Eli cut in here.
Oh, no, I was going to follow up on what you were saying and say, no, I don't think we have an immediate response. And that's something that's been kind of striking throughout this, is just really slow responses from city leaders and officials here. We've seen that in other high profile incidents, like the mass shooting in Uptown that injured five people recently, where there was, you know, kind of no reaction for several days. And we just have this pattern of these high profile incidents happening, people speaking out, and then no response from city leaders, except, you know, a written statement of 5 days later from the mayor. And I think CATS leaders just did their first interview yesterday at WSOC yesterday night, and that was, you know, 6.5 days later. So that's really become a pattern here, and it's really striking that we're not seeing city officials do more and say more to try to reassure people after these high-profile crimes in Uptown and South End.
These incidents have become the norm nationwide. It is not unusual for this to happen anymore. They happen on the regular. And in Minneapolis this week, we saw the horrific incident of those children being shot at through stained glass windows while they were at Mass in the opening week of school. Disgusting and horrific. It's beyond description. And we've had guns fired randomly on streets uptown in the daytime and at night. Mary, what can you do to protect anybody, anywhere, at any time against incidents like this in a country where guns are rampant? And the incident on the CATS train was with a knife.
Yeah, well, I think people are frustrated, because at the same time that many city leaders are saying crime is going down, it's at, you know, lows of whatever year, they don't feel safe because there are incidents like this. And of course, public safety has become a big issue nationally. You saw Governor Kathy Hochul in New York send the National Guard and troops in the subways when people did not feel safe riding mass transit. And you have to do something about it. And that people here, I think, were frustrated because many who have ridden the light rail, and I do ride it occasionally, they very seldom see security on there. Even though there's an honor system for tickets, I don't think I've ever had a ticket checked. And you do see folks on there who obviously just ride back and forth. So it's a sense of, once people start to not feel safe, they don't ride it. They begin to doubt the leadership. Can you not keep it under control? They want to see some progress. And so even though, of course, it's impossible to ever protect everybody against everything, at the same time, people are saying, I think there's more you can do. Why aren't you doing it? And as Eli and Eric said, why do we not hear more about what's going on? Because after all, you're our leaders, and basically you're supposed to keep us safe.
Eric?
You know, Mike, one of the things that's always puzzled me a little bit in the last few years, I know crime is down right now, but we have talked many times on this show about record paces of homicides in Charlotte. And each time, while there were a lot of statements by police and neighborhood groups and things like that, it never really factored into local elections to a significant degree. I'm not sure why that is. And what I wonder is whether some of what we're talking about now, what Mary and Eli just mentioned, if that begins to seep into the upcoming city elections that we have in November.
Well, and that's the concern of several on council. We already heard Dimple Ajmera refer to the referendum that will be on the November ballot, and she was not the only one.
all of us here who know what is on the ballot this November, which is the continuance of the expansion of our transit system.
That's District 6 Councilman Edwin Peacock, who is currently an at-large candidate for that body. Their concern is, of course, that the act of violence that we experienced on Friday and others like that might discourage voters from saying yes to the one-cent sales tax for transit because of safety concerns. Is that a reality? Might people look at it that way?
Yes, I think so. And you look at what's going on with high-profile incidents like this, and you know, 2.5 months before this referendum, this is kind of the worst thing that could happen for transit and transit leaders. But at the same time, I think Eric made a really good point, which is that these issues have not factored into municipal elections. And I think that's a reflection of the fact that there's not really any robust general elections in Charlotte anymore. Everything is going to be decided in the primary in less than 2 weeks. There's no opposition for the mayor. The districts are all going to be decided in the primary except for District 6. At large is probably going to be in the primary. And, you know, we've had, I think, fewer than 800 people vote so far in early voting in municipal elections. So if you had, like, a robust mayor's race, I think this would be an issue. But there's not.
Right.
I'm not sure that's going to continue in a sense, because we do have a president of the United States saying that cities are unsafe. And so you have that rhetoric. I have seen this particular crime in Charlotte show up nationally of people using this as evidence to say this, you have to change your leadership. You see, the president is right. I'm not sure. We'll have to see, because people, I have sensed with this particular crime, are very dissatisfied, particularly since this man had been in the system.
But
and
who
that's
could they
part
even
of it
vote
too,
against?
You know? Yeah.
Edwin Peacock also referenced the mass shooting in Uptown this summer that left 5 people wounded, and he didn't want to point fingers of blame, but
we are in a gap period right now. We do not have a police chief that is coming in. He is going out. Is that the cause of this? I don't believe so. I'm not pointing a finger at CMPD. But what I do want is I want us to be proactive and not be reactive to this.
What difference would it make if we have an outgoing police chief who's leaving at the end of the year versus an incoming who's just taken the job of being the chief of police? He just said that he didn't want to point any fingers, so why mention it at all? Is he saying that we're not being proactive in our efforts because of an outgoing police chief and that's resulting in this violence? What's he saying here?
Well, I think if you're in an organization where the leadership is kind of marking time and is going to turn over, I'm not saying this is happening.
Well,
but
this has been going on for, this is not new.
You don't launch bold initiatives.
This didn't just happen Friday for the first time.
Yeah, but we've known the police chief is an interim for most of this year now, and it's difficult to launch big initiatives and make big changes in an organization where you know someone else is going to come in a few months and maybe change everything.
So Mayor Vialiles made a statement saying, first and foremost, my thoughts and prayers go out to the young woman's family and friends. And that seems to have set off the Fraternal Order of Police, as you referenced, Erica. They posted a statement on Facebook reading, quote, "To Charlotte voters, do not, all caps, be fooled. We need new leadership starting at the top." And they criticized the mayor for coddling, their words, the man responsible, who they say served 6 years in prison for armed robbery. They also took Edwin Peacock to task for using this tragedy to promote the transit sales tax. They say the mayor should have spoken, quote, about the lack of resources the city provides for serious mental health issues. I only have 30 seconds. Is that a city responsibility? Isn't that more the responsibility of the county, the state, the federal government?
Yes, that is more a county responsibility when we talk about human services.
Okay, so I'm going to come back. We'll talk some more about this Fraternal Order of Police Facebook post, which is blistering in its criticism of city leadership. We'll talk about that when we come back. And then it's back to school. James Farrell's here quietly waiting for his opportunity to talk about schools and what's going on there. And we'll give him that chance in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Eli Portillo, senior editor at WFAE News. Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and the host of their Equal Time podcast. And in a moment, we will hear from the alleged James Farrell, the education reporter we have here at WFAE News. We were talking just before the break about the blistering Facebook post that the Fraternal Order of Police, the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Fraternal Order of Police, posted with regard to the stabbing on the light rail line on Friday night. They pointed out that Charlotte city leaders, quote, gave $650 million to a man that Forbes estimates is worth $23 billion. They're, of course, referring to what the city council did a couple of years ago with regard to helping David Tepper upfit Bank of America Stadium. They write, quote, imagine what $650 million could have done to improve safety on light rail. Their tone seems to indicate this light rail tax proposal has found yet another detractor, because they are beginning to emerge from the nooks and crannies of Charlotte. Some supporters and some leaders who can't take a stand continue to point to the transportation options and opportunities that this plan will provide. Here's how Mecklenburg County Manager Mike Bryant, who cannot take a stand on this, positioned it on Charlotte Talks this week.
It's going to increase mobility across this community to help individuals secure jobs and employment in parts of the community that currently they may be challenged getting to. So because of that, I think that's a huge advantage. When you're helping move individuals from point A to point B.
Still, headwinds are blowing. Will they continue to build? Will there be enough voters who agree with the Fraternal Order of Police that our priorities are out of whack? That's certainly the fear, isn't it?
That's absolutely the fear. And I think that one of the things that this does, again, this is a horrible loss of life, but it turns into more than that, becoming a political issue. It really captures a lot of attention, and it gets people focused on something that they really haven't been focused on a lot. And Mike, when you're talking about a low turnout election, as this one is likely to be, that is something that I think you're going to see. Well, you already are seeing opponents of the transit tax are going to use this, and they think they can refer to what you mentioned, that there have been other episodes on transit. We had the bus driver, you know, there's many of them that we've talked about, who have lost lives or been severely injured, and that could be a focal point. And it's notable, Mike, when you're going up against an organization supporting this that has $3.5 million.
So we have to switch gears now, because I lose James Farrell to a school board meeting in just 15 minutes from now. And he's our education reporter, and he's geared up to talk about back to school. It was back to school, and from the nothing I've heard about this, James, I'm assuming that things went well.
Yeah, generally speaking, the report from CMS officials has been that it went pretty smoothly. Obviously, there's always going to be some hiccups, some delays on the buses occasionally. CMS officials attributed that mostly to drivers just learning their new routes and families learning where their bus stop is and new traffic on the roads that everyone's getting used to. Yeah. We also saw a hiccup this year with the new switch to Infinite Campus, which is the new student information system. All parents in the school district have to open up a portal with that. And as of the first day of school, I think they were only about 37% of the way through on that. But that's a statewide change, and that's something that school districts all over North Carolina are trying to navigate.
You did mention that there were minor delays on buses, but CMS Chief Operations Officer Tim Ivey says that's not abnormal for the first several days of school.
That does create some initial delays, but nothing that we have not seen, nothing unusual. And so as the week goes on, we typically see marked improvements.
And there were some driver shortages, just as there were teacher shortages. And we always have shortages of both at the top of the school year. But I understand that the situation's a little better this year than in years past.
Yeah, CMS officials have said that we've seen improvements in teacher vacancies in particular. I forget the exact number, but it's down a good bit. And we do have to acknowledge that there were 40 vacant positions cut in the budget last year as well. But CMS has also done a lot to improve its recruitment strategies. They have the at-home Initiative, trying to link teachers to affordable housing. They pushed for a raise in the teacher supplement for Mecklenburg County. And certainly we're a far cry from where we were 2 years ago when there were more than 500 vacancies to start the school year, somewhere around 200 right now.
And they reported they had 98 bus driver openings on opening day of school. That sounds like a lot to me. How do you operate and not have kids miss the bus or be incredibly late for school if you're short 98 drivers?
Yeah, that was really interesting to me because Tim Ivey there had actually said that they kind of always are operating around that amount, and they've just gotten really good at figuring out how to kind of cover routes and move things around like that. And it's just interesting how like it's become sort of almost normalized. Now, we've been hearing about bus driver shortages for so long, and it's just kind of become the expectation almost that there's going to be shortages.
So you mentioned the Infinite Campus Student Information Center a moment ago, and CMS told you that they are having a little difficulty getting parents to register. I think only 37% of families have signed up for this. First of all, what is this system, and why are only a third signed up?
Well, and to be clear, that was at the beginning of the week. I'm about to go to a press conference now where we'll hear where things are at by the end of the week. So hopefully, you know, maybe there's been some improvement since then. But this is basically the system where you can go to find your students' grades, their schedule, read up on their attendance. It houses all of the students' information. It's a shift. They used to use PowerSchool, which made headlines last year because of that big data breach. But the whole state decided to shift away from that and to go to Infinite Campus. As to why it's taking so long, CMS officials have basically said they kind of expected this. It's, you know, 141,000 families all figuring out how to use this new software all at once, all trying to get signed up and re-enrolled and all of that through this new system that's different to them. So it just, you know, takes some time.
Eli.
I'm one of those parents and one of those families. And, you know, just speaking personally, it's definitely a lot of work. You have to re-input everything, and you have to give permissions for everything, like your kid to be in the band and do PE and all those things. So getting 140 some thousand parents of various, you know, language proficiencies and engagement levels to do that is a heavy lift.
And access to computers.
Yes, exactly. And yes. I'm going to use a point of personal privilege to go on a rant here. The amount of apps that we have to use as parents now is crazy. You have Infinite Campus, Parent Square, Dojo, Facebook, and PayPams. Plus, you get critical information sent home via paper still. I mean, it's a lot to keep up with as a parent. I feel like my whole week has just been sorting through forms.
James.
Yeah, I think to that point, CMS had to clarify to families that Parent Square was actually different from Infinite Campus, that Infinite Campus is not replacing Parent Square, which is what a lot of families use for direct communications with the district. So it's also just an educational issue, too, right? Just making sure that everyone is aware of the change and how to make the change efficiently. They also said, you know, reach out to your school's data manager, but they've hinted that data manager is getting a lot of requests and questions, so I'm sure there's some backlog there. It just takes time to make that shift. And again, every school district across the state is kind of navigating the same thing.
And
of course, thing.
The most noteworthy hiccup of opening day was due to parents. Two parents were arrested for bringing weapons onto a school campus. What else do we know about this incident, James?
Well, we know that the two parents were arrested. They were found entering the building with them in the secure vestibule, so they were actually picked up on the scanners. I've seen some other reports saying that one of the parents had a box cutter and a gun on them, and another parent had a knife. And, you know, CMS said that they responded to this pretty immediately, and they were able to handle it pretty quickly. You know, there were some questions from the press on it, but otherwise was told that they handled it pretty quickly.
Do we know why they brought these guns?
I'm not sure why. I'm sure that's something that we can look into a little more.
Okay. And also, CMS has adopted this new safety protocol from a national foundation called I Love You Guys. What is that?
Yeah, so this is a new, basically the standard response protocol that all schools will be following to respond to different incidents, threats that might be happening on campus. The goal here, what CMS officials have said, is to try to create a more kind of common language that everyone understands. So when the school says we're going into a hold or a secure, everyone will know what that means. One of the things they've kind of hinted as to why they made this change was because they were almost like overusing the term lockdown. We would hear lockdown in response to a hold. whole bunch of different things, whether it was a threat outside of the school or, you know, police activity in the area. So this kind of has more of like a tiered approach where the different commands kind of hint at different things. A hold, for instance, basically just tells students to stay in their classrooms. There could be a medical incident happening, versus a lockdown, which signals something more serious is happening that's an immediate threat inside the building.
There's a new report that shows CMS is experiencing improvement in its early literacy scores from the last several years.
All of those skills build upon each other, which is why it's really critical for our students to be solid in the beginning in kindergarten and then build upon each of those as we increase.
CMS Superintendent Dr. Crystal Hill, but evidently scores are not rising enough for the district to meet a target set by the Board of Education. James, talk about that.
Yeah, so we've seen some improvement in the scores, which is obviously a good thing, but the school board has a plan to get more kids reaching benchmark on their early literacy assessments by 2029. So they have sort of these annual targets set for each grade and for each year to make sure they're staying on pace. And they fell just short of that. I believe they were shooting for 75% reaching benchmark on these tests, and they were at 72%. Again, that is an improvement over last year, and I'm sure that as long as they continue improving, they'll see that as a positive, but still trying to figure out how to close the gap and accelerate that rate of increase.
And ever since the pandemic, CMS and other school systems around the country have had a problem with chronic absenteeism. Now CMS is rolling out a standardized strategy to address that problem.
So the strategies that we have in place now is not just to simply track if students are coming to school or not, but based on the tier that they're in, the number of absences that they may be accumulating, making sure that we have gradually increasing interventions so we're not waiting until the problem is really bad. We've been intervening all along and tracking that.
Again, Crystal Hill, what kind of intervention is she talking about?
Right. So, you know, it kind of, when she talks there about that gradually increasing intervention, they have these kind of tiers set up. And if you have like two or three absences, that might be like a letter home, versus like 10 absences might be a home visit, and all the way up to more than 18 absences. That's when you start talking about like truancy court and things like that. And to be clear, CMS has had interventions in place before. What Crystal Hill had said was that the district wasn't really monitoring the interventions. They were just monitoring on a district-wide level the number of absences. And they said to better judge like what's working and how to improve it, they wanted to do a better job monitoring it and make sure all the schools and all administrators were kind of implementing these strategies with fidelity across the whole district.
And finally, changes to the SNAP food assistance program and to Medicaid as a result of maneuvers by the Trump administration are likely to affect the school lunch program. The recently passed One Big Beautiful Bill, which is now law, that ushered in these changes did not directly address the national school lunch program, as I understand it. So what are they saying the likely impact of this will be?
Right. So families who get SNAP or who get Medicaid are directly certified. They're automatically basically signed up for free lunch at their school. So the fact that the eligibility requirements for those programs have changed could impact those families, because they might still qualify for free lunch, but now instead of just being automatically certified, they're going to have to go and individually apply for that. And so a lot of advocates are worried that this might leave some people in the dust, or, you know, I might lose some people in the cracks, because there's a new kind of administrative burden that will be placed on families that have to go out of their way to sign up for this program.
And among those advocates who are worried is Abby Emanuelson. She's with the Schools for All North Carolina.
We know that there's like such an administrative burden. We know that people fall through the cracks. The same number of kids would be qualified, but they're just not going to have filled out the paperwork to actually qualify.
Are schools in a position to help these families who need it fill out these forms and get on board with this?
I think that's exactly why so many advocates are concerned about this, because obviously we hear all the time about budgets being tight. We also know that the state of North Carolina is going to have to do some cost sharing now with the SNAP program because of our error rate and how we calculate that. So that's going to make the General Assembly's budget tighter. And advocates are really trying to figure out how they can maybe help schools close the gap and continue to do that. But it's definitely going to be tight.
I mean, a lot of these kids get free breakfast as well, because they don't have resources at home, and the only hot meals they get are from the schools. I want to just go back just for a second, because I know you have to leave, and just dial in on this a little bit, because you report that schools where 25% of the student population qualify for school lunches through SNAP and Medicaid automatically receive them. You've said that. But schools on the cusp who see their percentage of those students drop below 25% lose or might lose universal access. How many schools fall into that category?
I'm forgetting the exact number right now, but it's quite a bit. I think it's something around 75% of schools qualify for, or at least part of the National School Lunch Program. How many of those get the CEP or the 25% that you're talking about there? I'm not sure. I'd have to look into that. But that's definitely part of the concern here from advocates, too, because there's kind of this concern of a drop-off where now schools that were kind of universally getting this for all students, all of a sudden all those families are, again, going to have to individually apply and check their eligibility, and that could lead to a whole cascading effect of trying to get people signed on.
James Farrell, our WFAE education reporter, has to leave us now because he's going to a meeting to find out more about this first week of school and how it came off at CMS. And he and Eli Portillo will be doing an entire hour on this on Tuesday here on Charlotte Talks. Thank you for being here, James. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike.
The Observer, Mary, examined one impact of the school voucher program, which is now full steam ahead. Proponents say these vouchers, which give money directly to students to help pay private school tuition, give these students greater choice. Opponents say these opportunity scholarships siphon off resources from the already underfunded public schools, and now some individuals, some indicators, are showing they may be leading to more segregated schools. Schools are already trending in that direction, so why is this adding to it?
Well, when they opened up the opportunity scholarships to folks of any income level, a lot of folks who already were in private schools got to use it. So that means why the overall numbers really didn't change. That's because a lot of the people that applied, many white folks, because many private schools are predominantly white, took advantage of it. And so that's why it's trending in that way. And even though the school system is pretty much as diverse, more students are going to individual schools which are with students of the same race. And even though these, some schools, I think they featured in the Observer, someone who was able to get her child who had special needs into a private school or that was able to use a voucher, that particular school used a sliding scale for tuition. Most private schools do not. And so the money that you get from these opportunity scholarships is most of the time not enough to cover full tuition. So that doesn't mean that everybody can take advantage of it and everybody has the same opportunity. And so the folks who are saying, yes, it does take money away, they do have a good argument, although others say the money, tax money, should follow the child. But the choice is not evenly divided. And folks say, well, why does this matter? Well, it matters because it's shown that, you know, when magnet schools here in Charlotte brought together students of different races, of different backgrounds, it really improves Tesco's stores overall. And we're supposed to be preparing children to operate as adults in a more integrated and diverse society.
I want to come back and just touch on that for a second, because we have a lot more stuff to cover here in the next 20 minutes. But I do want to touch on that when we come back. Mary Curtis is here along with Eli Portillo and Eric Spanberg. It's the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte. Aiming to inspire high school students through an international curriculum and IB diploma program, preparing them for college, careers, and a global community. More at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Eli Portillo, WFAE Senior News Editor, is with us this morning, along with Eric Spanberg, Managing Editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, and Mary C. Curtis, columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. We were talking just before the break about how the school voucher program may be leading to more segregated schools, kind of backtracking to segregated schools. And you mentioned that one of the benefits, the long touted benefits of integrated schools, is that it exposes children to people who are not like themselves. So they learn to have relationships with people from different backgrounds, different races, different ethnicities, etc. And that seems to make sense on the face of it. But we integrated the schools years ago, Mary, and I just want to get your take on this, because we integrated the schools years ago. Theoretically, that should have taken hold, and yet we are living now in an environment of rising white nationalism. How do you explain that?
Well, you know, I had on my Equal Time podcast a guest that you've had, James E. Ford, that works with an organization that deals with race and equity and education issues. And while we did legally desegregate, you know, we still have had a persistent achievement gap because we saw desegregated schools, you know, often they dismissed a lot of Black teachers and role models, and some of these issues of inequity still popped up in schools that were integrated. And those have persisted in society. We saw the pushback when schools were integrated, and that has never stopped. We have busing in this city, Charlotte Mecklenburg, and of course now when we stopped having it, schools have resegregated. So, I mean, the issues, you know, integration never was fully accepted by society. And we have people alive today who were those screaming about the kids who are integrating the schools. So those kinds of things and those issues still persisted. So yes, we have that. We have people now who are looking back to a past time that they say was idyllic, but it was not idyllic nor equitable for every American. And so going back to that, they're going to like dismiss the, you know, goals of it, which is to say, when you deal in a society where you're going to be working with, living among, interacting with people of all different races, and every study has shown that even in business, an integrated, diverse task force gets more done and is more successful, there will be folks who reject that. And so you have a leadership that is leaning into that by dismissing, it seems, every person of color, female, whatever, that's running organizations and hiring people who are less qualified, but by dint of being a white, straight male, they're saying you are reclaiming what was in the past and what should have always been. It's just difficult.
But that, well, we don't have time to talk about this, but yeah. That gets back to my original question, and that is integrating the schools actually working at all, given what we're going through? But that's a show for another day. We have to move on to another topic, and that's
I would say yes, but go on.
Okay, higher education. But UNC Charlotte has announced a freeze of non-essential hiring, and they've cut technology stipends for employees as a proactive measure in anticipation of possible cuts at the federal level. And meanwhile, official reports about lobbying Congress show that in the first half of this year, there have been significant increases in spending over that of previous years on advocacy efforts, lobbying by UNC Chapel Hill, Duke University, which are both research universities that have been severely impacted by Trump administration cuts. Davidson College has hired a lobbyist for the first time in the school's history. And UNC Charlotte is using a lobbying firm for the first time in a decade. Spending on these efforts alone, in this state alone, is coming in at the moment at about $1 million and rising. But they're lobbying Congress. And Congress did not make these changes. Donald Trump did, unilaterally. And there has been no pushback from Congress. So is this just a waste of time? Is this a misdirection of funds? Or might Congress actually listen, Mary?
Well, we know that our president is famous for paying attention to the last person who's spoken to him, you know, the last person in his ear. And obviously, companies have always been done this, to go to lobby the powerful to, you know, represent their interests. And many of these lobbying companies, you'll see that they're hiring are folks that have done business with Donald Trump, who have prominent Republicans like Richard Burr on their board and have an influence. So in a time, you know, another guest, the upcoming guest on my show was a former president of Spelman College, Dr. Beverly Tatum, which is, she has a book, the, you know, College Leadership in Turbulent Times. And these are these times. Now, North Carolina is complicated because our state doesn't even have a budget yet. And they call it an evolving federal funding landscape. So yes, they're going to have every voice there saying, we need this money. We need it for research and so many other things. And I'm, you know, they're just probably saying they don't want other people to be that last voice that Donald Trump hears. We'll see if it does any good.
So you mentioned the state not having a budget, and that is the case, which brings us to the legislature, because in addition to uncertainty over federal funding, until that state budget is passed, we will continue to operate on last year's fiscal year budget, which will leave teachers and other state employees without raises. And until that budget is passed, the UNC system will not receive the $46.3 million in recurring state appropriations the Board of Governors requested. The legislature did return to Raleigh this week. The budget, which is at an impasse because of disagreements among Republicans in the House and Republicans in the Senate, was not on the agenda. Eric, why was the budget not on the agenda?
Because they're nowhere near an agreement. There is not consensus, as you said, between the Republican leadership in the House and the Senate. It looks like late September probably is the soonest that it will happen. And it's interesting, Mike, because as you mentioned, we're having all these mini sessions where a handful of legislators come in maybe once a month. And remember, going back to July, there were many budgets passed to get at least some of these new measures in place. And so it's what we see so often in government. It's you need a deadline, but you need more than a deadline, yeah, because the deadline passes and then you start cobbling things together. And here we are.
They're evidently going to have monthly mini sessions. And at this latest mini session that occurred this week in Raleigh, members were told that they didn't have to show up. And so many of them didn't show up. Among the people who didn't show up, Senate Leader Phil Berger and House Speaker Destin Hall. So what was the purpose of this and how unusual is it?
I'm not sure what the point is. I'm speechless to come up with a point, you know, other than keeping some things moving and in process. But as you say, nothing big is going to happen. Everybody in that chamber, or I guess on Zoom, knows that there is not the consensus to pass the budget. And so they're just kind of pushing things around until
shouldn't they be coming to Raleigh to be delving into discussions, in-person discussions about the budget so they can reach a consensus and pass a budget? Isn't that how it works?
That's usually how it works. Okay. Eli looks like he wants to chime in. Yeah. Maybe he has a better answer, because I really don't have a good answer for why they're not spending more time on this in person.
Well, you know, it really comes down to, I think, whether Phil Berger in the Senate and Destin Hall in the House can reach an agreement. And if those two Republican leaders don't have an agreement, then everyone else is kind of on the sidelines. Democrats did use it this week to show up and kind of score some points and hold a press conference and say, hey, you know, we're here. Where are our Republican colleagues? Let's get a budget. There is some advantage, though, for Phil Berger in just letting things hang out, because if there's no budget, then prior year funding continues. And the tax increases cuts that are already in state law that the House wants to delay, but the Senate wants to enact, those House or those budget cuts aren't on the table. So for Phil Berger, just hanging out is not the worst thing in the world.
And one of the things that may delay the budget even further is the fact that I think it was yesterday, at least it was announced by Tricia Cotham, that she won't be around for a while. She's going to be out of the public eye for an unknown amount of time because of medical issues. On social media, she announced, quote, I've been recovering the last few weeks from medical procedures due to serious complications. I must have a big surgery this week. Recovery will be intense and lengthy. And she said she would be incommunicado for a while. Now, they no longer have, the Republicans no longer have a veto-proof supermajority. So does it matter that she's not available, or does it matter that they need that one vote critically?
Go ahead, Eli.
I was going to say, if there are veto overrides that come up and there's a one vote margin, that could theoretically matter. It could play into the outcome. And also, you know, aside from the vote totals, Tricia Cotham has also risen to a really prominent and public place since switching from the Democratic Party. So, you know, for her to be incommunicado is a strong ally of leadership who's also not present.
So we've already spoken a bit about how Medicaid and SNAP benefits may be reduced because of Trump administration maneuvers. Medicaid funding is also hanging in the balance without a state budget being passed. The state expanded Medicaid, if we all recall, only after a promise that the federal government would fund it, pick up 90% of the cost of Medicaid. 680,000 North Carolinians have gained access since the expansion, but it isn't only individuals who have benefited from expansion. So have rural hospitals and healthcare providers. And this week, Eli, our Nick Delacanal spoke to a doctor and a hospital administrator about the likely impact of these cuts in rural areas. What was he told?
Well, in rural areas in particular, they're already facing shortages of doctors, shortages of payments for hospitals, long-term trends like hospital closures and consolidation. So while all Medicaid recipients could be affected by this, Medicaid expansion recipients, rural folks, rural providers are really concerned that if they lose some of their funding from these patients, they're going to see a cascading effect very quickly.
Dr. Laura Uchik is one of those healthcare providers. She says Medicaid expansion has been a game changer because patients can now receive the care they need and are not skipping visits because of the expense.
You know, I could order people tests now and they get done. And they're not charging an arm and a leg. My patients are able to get evaluated for the conditions they need to be evaluated for. They can see specialists. They can access life-saving medication.
And evidently, these healthcare professionals are particularly, they're expressing extreme concern over people who have type 1 diabetes. Dr. Uchik says if treatment becomes unavailable, these patients will die. Is that what was happening prior to Medicaid expansion?
Well, it's hard to remember now because it feels like it was ancient history, but it was only a few years ago that insulin was a major cost in the news all the time. And for type 1 diabetes patients who have to pay for insulin for their whole lives, that can be a real barrier. It was an issue in the presidential race. Former President Joe Biden touted bringing down insulin prices, and you know, if that expansion was rolled back and people went back to paying hundreds or even thousands of dollars for insulin doses that they require to live, Dr. Uchik was expressing the fear that some of them will say, hey, I'm going to try to manage this myself and just eat less sugar and not shell out for, you know, this medicine. I'm going to skimp on it. And that's really dangerous.
Tim Evans, who is the CEO of Mountain Community Health Partnership in Mitchell and Yancey counties, also spoke to WFAE's Nick Delacanal about the uncertainty people are experiencing, many of whom are still recovering from Hurricane Helene. But he also has sympathy for state lawmakers because they face an uncertain future.
I feel real sympathy for them trying to figure out how to run the state, given that they don't have any idea what's coming tomorrow from Washington.
Uncertainty is a running theme in this administration in every aspect of international and national economics and more. It is rural counties who face the most to lose from any Medicaid cuts. Rural counties that voted for Donald Trump. How do you explain this?
Well, you know, I think people want to see policy outcomes that are not always in line with one particular thing. So, you know, you have people voting on different values, immigration, et cetera, who maybe don't think what's going to happen there. Plus, I will also add, Donald Trump said repeatedly he would not cut Medicaid. So, you know, a lot of people who benefited from Medicaid expansion, I think, probably relied on that during the campaign.
And it becomes real when it hits you. I mean, so many people have really forgotten the common good, but when it hits home, like, you know, your rural station or your rural hospital closes, then it's like, oh, that's what that was about. And we've seen with healthcare that you need early treatment because if you hold off and wait, it becomes much more serious. You go to the emergency room and it costs everyone, including taxpayers, much more money.
And it isn't just rural counties that may have to take a different approach if Medicaid or other funding is cut. In addition to possible cuts in state funding, counties faced other potential cuts from the federal government. Mecklenburg County's new manager, Mike Bryant, was on this program on Wednesday and said if those cuts come, the responsibility will fall on the counties, and that could hurt Mecklenburg.
The county's going to have to make some very tough decisions in terms of cuts as well. I receive $171 million from the federal government in federal revenue. if we lose a certain percentage of those revenues that we receive reimbursement for providing services to our community, we can't supplant that.
So everybody is in a wait-and-see mode. And they're also in a wait-and-see mode over the upcoming Panthers season. Thank you. The roster is set. They've traded out the Adam. Is it Thielen?
Adam Thielen.
Evidently a rising star. He's going back to his home team, the Minnesota Vikings. I suppose that makes him happy. It makes the people in Minnesota happy. Should we be happy?
Mary?
Well, the Panthers are going for youth. They're going for their new rookie wide receiver and a young receiving core. So their hopes are high, and right now ours are too.
And opening day will be Sunday, September 7th in Jacksonville against the Jaguars. I won't even ask you what you think. Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, Mary C. Curtis, columnist and host of RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Earlier, James Farrell, WFAE's education reporter, and of course, Eli Portillo, senior editor at WFAE News. Thank you all.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.